It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell, in for Rob Ferret today.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to an expert from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling about a new study showing that American students have a lower-than-average level of financial literacy.
First, the ability of some fish and eels to generate electricity has captivated human imagination for ages.
Now, a team of researchers from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in collaboration with other institutions, have managed to trace the genetic and molecular code of the electric organ in eels and other electric fish.
Their research was published recently in the journal Science, and with us is one of the lead researchers, Michael Sussman. He is a professor of biochemistry and the director of the Biotechnology Center at the UW-Madison. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. I want to talk about sort of the mystery of electric fish, electric eels, because people have known about these things for an awfully long time. What are some of the questions people were asking in the past about how does this happen? How do these animals generate that kind of shock, that kind of power?
Yes. well, it's hundreds of years. In the old days, in the 1800s, when the nature of electricity was first being discovered, they knew the stun was an electric stun. And at parties, people would hold hands, and the last person would hold a fish, and then the number of people that felt the tingle would be related to the size of the eel. So they were beginning to understand. And since then, we've learned a lot more about the function of the electric organ, which is actually in navigation and communication. The water in South America is very dark, and the eyesight of these fish is very poor. And much like birds in our forests, these fish are using electric discharges to get their mate's attention, as well as to see by bouncing off of the surface of the floor of the river, like bats with radar. They're using electricity to help navigate.
So let's talk about the research that you've been involved in, because I got to tell you, when I'm thinking about this, I don't even know exactly where I would start. But you got into some very complex territory here, and I'll just let you tell the story. Where do you start when you're looking at trying to figure this out?
So for 30 years, I've been interested in how proteins transduce energy. They convert chemical energy into either mechanical energy, like our muscles, or chemical energy into electrical energy, but on a very small scale, for example, in our brains. The power there is very small. It's just informational. But there's this unique group of animals, only about 800 species of fish, that have taken a muscle and gotten rid of the contractibility and instead have increased the ability to generate electricity. And I consider these electric fish one of nature's gifts, because if we can learn how to make those special types of cells and organs, we can start in the future engineer organisms that can do it that don't normally do it. It's not impossible to imagine. We are conquering how to convert, for example, embryonic stem cells into heart cells. That is now quite possible, and people are doing it. So perhaps we'll someday, instead of having nickel-cadmium batteries as pacemakers, we'll have a little electric organ. I don't know if that's going to take 10 years or 100 years, but that's the molecular details of what we learned about how the electrocyte functions and develops will be used someday for that purpose.
And tell me a little bit about what you learned in terms of sort of the evolution of all this, because as I understand it, we're not talking about one evolutionary path here. We're talking about, what, five or six?
Right. Yeah, that's what's very interesting, and this has happened several times in nature. This organ independently evolved at least six times. We compared three species in each of three different of those six lineages, and ask the question, what common genes are being used to create the electric organ? And we found, out of the 20,000 or so genes in the electric fish, we found about 100 that we think are involved in that process. And very similar, these same 100 seem to be in each of the three times. So evolution has used the same toolkit at least three times and created this very unique organ.
Yeah, that idea of having these independent paths, how significant is that when we're talking about the development of, you know, a function like this?
It's actually, I don't think it's that unusual. I'm not an evolutionary expert.
Sure.
I do want to mention that this group is extremely interdisciplinary. I'm the genomicist. I'm used to thinking about all 30,000 genes and proteins all at once. But many of the other people in the group are more what we call drill-down biologists, ichthyologists. Many of them have been studying electric fish all their careers, either in the wild, asking about how they evolve, or what ecological niche do they provide. And there's others. There's a neurobiologist in the group. There's computational experts, because computationally, it's a very difficult thing to assemble a genome as well as learn how the genes are operating. So none of us alone could have done this. And I'm very honored to have been one of the first to put together this team. We started 10 years ago with a conversation between myself and one of the authors, James Albert, I got just fascinated. I've always been fascinated by the electric eel, but his conversation, he then took me to the Amazon with him on one of his expeditions. He discovers new species of fish. That's what thrills him. I wouldn't know anything about that. I like to grind things up and figure out what the gene sequences are and what those genes are doing. And together we did something any one of us wouldn't have been able to do.
That had to be a thrill.
Yes. I do want to also say my graduate students on this project, especially Lindsay Traeger, who this is a major part of her thesis, she's a co-first author. And one of the wonderful things about being at the University of Wisconsin is that we have the best graduate students in the world, without a doubt. Not only smart as a whip, but very brave, because there was no funding in my lab at the time when she joined, and that was the one she did. I was able to get funding for it, but also she just spent 2 weeks in Peru and studying the electric fish in their environment and under fairly dangerous circumstances. And now she's got all the pieces to make her career out of it. And I'm very proud of what she's done. And I'm also proud of everyone else in the group.
So where does this research go next?
Wow. So this is the first complete sequence for an electric fish. That's Electrophorus electricus. And seriously, we think we have a handle on the handful of transcription of DNA binding proteins that we believe may be able to convert a muscle cell into an electrocyte. And we're going to try some of those experiments. Jamie Thompson is the pioneer of this technology, developed here at the University of Wisconsin, and it's been developed elsewhere. So making an electrocyte in organisms that, like zebrafish, but don't normally have them, is one possibility. We're also going to start studying what we call the proteome and the metabolome. Just like the genome is all the DNA, the proteome is all the proteins, and the metabolome are all the small molecules. And we think this will teach us a lot about how muscles and brains operate. It's so unusual, we think it's going to have some very important insights on how these other organs are operating, because these other organs are big energy transducers. And but the uniqueness of the electrocyte in the electric organ, I think, has some secrets that we want to reveal.
Wow, a lot more than a parlor trick. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today. We've been talking with Michael Sussman, professor in the Department of Biochemistry and the director of the Biotechnology Center at the UW-Madison. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk about the lasting appeal of the Rubik's Cube, which turned 40 years old this year.
First, we are taking a look at financial literacy in the United States. A new international study from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development ranked American students in the middle of the group when it comes to financial knowledge.
Australia, New Zealand, and Poland all outranked us. Shanghai topped the list of financially literate students. At the bottom of the list were Israel, Italy, and Colombia.
Gail Cunningham is here to talk about the study and how we can better educate American students about money. She is the spokesperson for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. And Gail, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Happy to be visiting with you all this afternoon.
Well, it is good to have you along. I want to talk about the idea of financial literacy and maybe start by getting a very basic definition of what that would be, particularly as it applies to students in this age group. We're talking about kids that are like 15 years old or so, right?
Well, when we think of financial literacy, one of the words that's used is competency or financial education, and all of that sounds very boring until you need to be more financially literate. A 15-year-old, all that's on their mind is maybe the newest cell phone app. Now, they're too young to even sign on the dotted line to get a contract to purchase a cell phone or the plan. However, in 3 short years, looks like they're going to have to really stretch and improve their financial competence because they're going to be standing on their own 2 feet as 18-year-olds have reached the age of majority and can be responsible for their own contractual decisions. That could mean that they're in a heap of trouble.
So basically, they have to have an idea of what cash is, what credit is, what a checking account is, all those sorts of things that a lot of us, it's part of our DNA because we've been dealing with it for so long.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the old joke is that child is with the mother at the grocery store and they get into the checkout line. The child's begging for something there, the point of sale. And the mother says, well, no, we can't afford it. I don't have money for that. And the child says, well, just charge it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the financial institutions, the issuers of credit cards, have done a very good job of distancing us from our hard-earned money. We all know that it's easier to spend with plastic. More plastic equals more temptation. The folks that we have observed through the years who will change over to a cash-only basis spend about 20% less. And here's the interesting part. They don't feel as though they're deprived of anything. It's simply that their awareness has been increased that when they get up to that checkout counter, they're going to have to peel out their hard-earned money to pay with, and that makes them think twice about their purchase.
And there again, that implies a certain amount of knowledge. So as you take a look at the results of this study, what do you make of the United States ranking? Students ranked about mid-pack there in terms of their financial literacy. Are you surprised by that? Are we getting better or worse? Or is that kind of where we've been ranking?
Well, it shows that there's lots of room for improvement, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I perhaps am not as surprised as some of your listeners might be because I'm aware that less than half of the states require mandate a financial literacy course for graduation. Now, they may throw in a chapter some course along the way in high school. But to truly dig in for even a semester about financial literacy and teach these young adults how to manage on their own, again, is a requirement in less than half of all the states. So there's lots of room there for improvement. We've been talking about this, though, for a long time. In the NFCC's Financial Literacy Survey, we asked the question, where did you learn the most about personal finance? And predictably, the majority answered that they learned it at home or from their parents. And that sounds nice, and as it should be, until you realize that the parents may not be very good teachers. In another question, we ask people to grade themselves on their grasp of personal finance. And the more than 2,000 folks that answered our survey, 41% of them gave themselves a grade of C, D, or F. So, again, if you put this together, we realize that the parents who are giving themselves a grade of C, D, or F are the ones who are instilling the financial habits in the children. So, again, there's a lot of opportunity here. The onus is on the parents, but they have the opportunity to improve 2 generations, their own and their children's, if they will step up to the plate and improve their grasp of financial literacy.
So let me ask you, what are the implications of this for the future? And can you pull any headlines out of the news right now that might help you demonstrate that point?
Well, here we are coming off of high school graduation and young adults going into the workforce or out to their first year of college. And these folks likely, as we just discussed, have not had training in their high school. And if they had it at home, it may not have been the best. So they are likely to respond like a kid in a candy store, a credit candy store. And there's nothing sadder for us to see than young people who graduate from college with a diploma in one hand and in the other student loan debt and credit card debt. They simply do not know how to responsibly manage credit because they have not been taught. And these folks, they're going to want to buy a car. They're going to want to get their own apartment. And they can't even do so much as calculate simple interest.
Now, how do you, I mean, some of that obviously is a question of literacy. Some of it's a question of maturity. And I imagine you're never going to have like a perfect system there. But as you look at the system today, is it that much more complicated than when a lot of us were young? Because, you know, when I graduated from high school, there was no financial literacy programs of any kind that I'm aware of. Has the world changed that much in 35 years that it is that much more complicated?
I would suggest that it has. I say all the time that personal finance is very complex. As a matter of fact, people have a hard time admitting that. They know that they're in financial distress, but they feel guilty or humiliated about it. They think they should be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and that's kind of our culture here in America, and they wait too long to reach out for help. But it is a constantly moving target. You know, just think about the financial apps on your phone or enhancements such as, you know, online banking, automatic bill payment. Perhaps when you graduated from high school, if you needed a loan, you simply went to the bank on the corner, and the person across the desk may have been the dad of your best friend. Well, now if you need a loan, it's maybe you get it online, of course, from a stranger and a bank that doesn't even have a physical location.
When you look at a place like Shanghai that wound up at the top of the list, do you have any idea of what they are doing right to get them to the top of the list? And is there room for improvement there as well?
Well, it sounds like they're doing a lot right. I certainly don't know any details about it, but I think there's a lesson to be learned. Maybe we could consider this a teachable moment here in America. I'm not sure why Americans do not embrace the idea, other than with words, of educating the young about financial literacy. That's where it all starts. You know, even very young children can understand the concept of an allowance or of earning money for their household chores. We encourage, you know, the 80-10-10 rule. You can keep 80% of what you have or earn, give away 10% and save 10%. If skills like that are passed along to children early in life, I project that they will be well served by those people graduating and getting that first job. If they're fortunate to land that first job, we always recommend that they still pretend that they're in college and living on that college income for a while until they really get well entrenched in that new job, prove themselves, make sure they're going to keep that job. And since it's the largest paycheck they probably ever had, if they could get started early, contributing to their retirement plan, et cetera, they'll be well served for the remainder of their work life.
So as you look at, think about the curriculum for what an ideal class might look like for somebody who's in high school, taking into account that they are young and don't have a lot of exposure to this, what would be some of the elements of that kind of course?
You know, when I have taught courses like that, gone into the high schools before and talked about personal finance, I'd give everybody $1,000 in play money. More, you know, their eyes would get big. That's more money than they'd ever seen. And so I'd go, well, who all would like a new car? Well, of course, every hand in the room shot up. And so I said, okay, give me back $300 of that $1,000 I just gave you because you've just made a car payment. Okay, who would like to live out on their own in their own apartment? Of course, everybody's all up for that idea. So we recommend no more than 30% of your take-home go to housing. So I had them give me another 300. So now they've spent 600 of their $1,000. They haven't eaten. They haven't put food on the table. They haven't paid their utilities. They haven't bought any medicine or clothes, et cetera. You see where I'm going with this. And suddenly they're out of money. And that's a very eye-opening experience, albeit with play money. But soon enough, they're going to be in the real world with real money, with real accountability problems.
We're talking to Gail Cunningham from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling about the topic of how to better educate American students about money.
And we're taking your calls next. How did you learn about how to manage money? Did your parents or your teachers help you, or were you just out on your own? And how do you think that kids should be taught? How do you teach your own kids about financial literacy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. News is coming up next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about with Gail Cunningham from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling about teaching students financial literacy.
And we're taking your calls now. So how did you learn about managing money? Did you learn the hard way, or did you get a job and work your way through college and do all the right things and save everything, and now you're in a great spot? How do you teach your kids or grandkids about this thing we call financial literacy? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments or questions, or you can send us an email, talk@wpr.org. Gail, we do have some callers lined up. We'll get to those in just a second. But while I was listening to you right before the break talking about talking to high school students about what it's like to have a paycheck and housing costs so much and the car is going to cost so much and taking the play money away and so forth, it seems to me that you've got a lot of competition in the media, in commercials that talk about how to finance a car and buying the latest gadget, the last iPod and so forth. How do you compete against that sort of "we've got to have it right now" attitude that seems to be very prevalent?
Well, you're exactly right. You hit the nail on the head. When you think about it, people never talk about the cost of credit, how much the total cost will be of X. You mentioned a car. It will only be advertised by the monthly payment. You don't see how much that car costs you, even on the lot when you drive it off, or much less when you finish paying off the car. Everybody thinks in terms of affordability. If I can afford that monthly payment, then I can afford the item. And we've got to get beyond that and teach children, have them open their eyes and have help them to open their eyes to the true cost of credit. And we have teachable moments all the time. I referenced earlier the child's begging for something in the checkout line. That's a teachable moment. You know, and I would suggest showing the children money. Plastic's too abstract. You know, the child said, "Well, just charge it." He doesn't connect the plastic and the money. So show them real money. Let them get used to handling it, even if it's putting the money in the toll bucket as you're driving to work or whatever, to connect the dots between it costs money to do things. And I think that will serve them well. You know, it's summertime now, so you could look for different creative ways to teach your children about money while they're home. And they certainly know all about the internet and playing games and apps. They probably know more about them than most of us do. So that you could find those that they would enjoy and, again, conceptually help them learn about money. I always like to see a family council. For one thing, a greater buy-in is going to equal a greater result. So I'd have everybody sit around that proverbial kitchen table and say, "Hey, How can we save some money? We all want to do, if you have a goal in mind, do such and such on your vacation right before school starts or whatever. And what can we do to find some money, some hidden money in our budget? And you can do anything for 30 days. So have anybody in the family who's old enough to spend money, write down every cent they spend, come back together, put it all out on the table, and look at it and jointly decide where you can cut back, and that'll go into your vacation fund or your new car fund or whatever. Make it fun. This does not have to be drudgery to save money. You know, we ask in another survey, do you consider a budget freeing or restrictive? Most people found it restrictive, when in reality, a budget just helps you determine how you want to spend your hard-earned money. There's nothing negative about it. A lot of people think budget's a four-letter word. If you can't stand that, call it a spending plan.
Let's get a couple of phone calls in here and begin with Jeffrey, who joins us from Rio. Hi, Jeffrey.
I was very fortunate back in the late 60s to go to high school economics class, and we had a teacher by the name of Mr. Farron who made us go through a course that he called the John Madison course. And in there, he would give us a certain amount of money, a certain amount of kids, and then he would send us out into the community, and we'd have to talk to landlords, we'd have to talk to car dealerships, we'd have to talk to insurance agents and find out, you know, how much it costs and how much we could afford, and we did a whole project on that, and that really gave me a good base of what to go on when I got older. Did I make mistakes? Of course, but it sure gave me a really good base.
And sounds like a really good real-world experience. Jeffrey, thanks for so much for the call. Let's move on to Bill now, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Hi, you talked about teachable moments, and I recall as a 12-year-old, and it sticks with me today, that it was having a paper route, and that it was a matter of having to go to work each day, having to collect the money, having to pay my bill, and actually saving for something that I wanted. I'm not sure those opportunities are quite as available today as they once were, although it may be snow shoveling or cutting the lawns, but children today don't seem to have that same direction as to going out and earning money with so many of the other competing activities that they have today.
Bill, thanks so much for that call. And Gail Cunningham, a couple of calls there, and both of those calls very much rooted in dealing in the real world.
Well, that's right. And I'll comment on Bill's call that our boys mowed lawns. And as much as they might not have wanted to get up in the heat and go out and spend their Saturdays mowing lawns, we had them do it. And they had to get their own accounts. They had to keep the books. They had to service the machinery, the lawnmower, the weed eater, et cetera. They had to pay taxes, et cetera. So that has served them well. And it's real interesting to observe how your own children treat money. One of them probably still has the first dime he ever earned off of mowing lawns, and the other one couldn't wait to get to the mall and spend the money. So that's all interesting. But, you know, there are still opportunities, and I hope that parents are still in charge of their children and can tell them that if they want something or other, that they need to have skin in the game. We have found that really helps so much for children to take care of that new pair of tennis shoes. You know, school shopping's coming up. They're going to claim that everybody has this certain brand or whatever, and it's probably going to be over $100. Help your children figure out ways to earn that money, and you match the money, and I promise you they're going to take much better care of that item.
All right, Gail, thanks so much for being with us today.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Look forward to next time.
That was Gail Cunningham, spokesperson for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. This is Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's time for Wisconsin Life. In the back of the La Crosse Area Hmong Mutual Assistance Association is a blacksmith shop where people melt their own metal and pound hot, glowing orange strips of it into knives. WPR's Maureen McCollum recently visited the shop where she met apprentice Kong Mong Yang and master blacksmith Tang Kai Vang. Kong translates for Tang Kai.
This is actually the very first knife that I made that looks kind of really decent. The belly and the shape of it is really, it's really well. The belly is the sharp part, the widest part from the back to the blade. He's made probably like 2,000 or 3,000 knives just in Thailand and Laos. Right now, we just use kind of like scrap pieces of metal. So a lot of blacksmith master here like using is car shocks because they're really malleable and they keep their sharpness. So they use that in like lawnmower blades. Once they get like dulled or like not used, we use that to like, make knives. For a normal like a small knife, which is about 6 inches, it's good for like just cutting fruits and vegetables and outside like gardening work. And then we also have the bigger knives, which are like a foot and a half, I want to say. They're really good for cutting meat and also cutting like small brushes. He said the one that he likes the most are the Bing Hong knife that's like cut up on the tip, and it's used to cut like branches and brushes and also doing farm work. In Thailand, there's this this plant, almost like a tree plant, for pigs to eat. And you go cut them down and you just like chop it up and then you give it to the pigs. Those are his favorite ones. I wasn't born in the United States, but I was like pretty much raised here, so I don't know a lot of stuff about Hmong people, and so it's always like a good thing to know more about my own culture. So when he was young, he didn't really know how to blacksmith, but he kept watching and watching his grandfather and his cousins when he like immigrated to Thailand in 1979. They didn't really have anything to do there. So when they closed down that the camp there and they had to move somewhere else, he had no way of making income. So that's when he actually started doing more blacksmith to support himself and his family. What they did is they built a blacksmith shop and they made knives and hoes and then machetes and all this other tools for the Thai people, and they would come and buy it, or they could bring their old hoes that are bented and stuff, and they would fix it for them. And also they didn't have anything to do at all, so that's all they could do. Chong Kai is a really, really great blacksmith. He is my mentor, and he's also more like almost like a grandfather to me. Like I never really had grandparents that I knew. Like one thing he taught me is like just keep on trying, and like you'll always succeed if you try.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. You can catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8 o'clock, and you can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Forty years ago, a Hungarian inventor came up with a simple premise: create a fist-sized cube made up of smaller, colorful cubes that could twist around. The man was Erno Rubik, and his device is what we now know as the Rubik's Cube.
Now, the cube hit it big back in the 1980s, but unlike other fads of that decade, the Rubik's Cube has gone on to have a long and fruitful existence. It is still challenging and still entertaining us to this day. But why has such a seemingly innocent toy kept us coming back for more?
Joining us now is Ariel Sabar. He's an author, journalist, and correspondent for Smithsonian Magazine, and he wrote a recent piece called Behind the Unceasing Allure of the Rubik's Cube. Ariel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So at its peak, just how popular was the Rubik's Cube? Can you paint us a picture?
Yeah, I mean, it was hugely popular. I mean, if you were alive in the early 80s, you remember this. But, I mean, you know, it was sort of like the it toy. Everyone needed to have one. And there was one estimate that, like, one out of seven or one out of five people across the globe had, like, held a Rubik's Cube at some point. And so it was really this sort of dominant toy, starting with its debut at the New York Toy Fair in 1980. And then sort of lasting until about 1982, it sort of like it got very, very hot, and then it kind of flamed out very, very quickly in about 82.
Can we hear a little bit about the origin story? Where did this thing come from?
Yeah, so it's kind of neat. The Erno Rubik was this young professor of interior design in what was then Iron Curtain, Hungary. He was living with his parents. He wasn't sort of this rich entrepreneur or anything. He was a pretty modest, shy, pale, short guy. And he taught this class and on interior design that was called Form Studies. And the idea was to kind of teach these students about the abstract properties of shape. And, he was trying to sort of spice up the class, make it a little bit more interesting. And so he got obsessed with this idea of, like, a cube. And what could you do with a cube? On the one hand, a cube is sort of this perfect embodiment of symmetry, right? It's equal on all sides. On the other hand, would there be a way to kind of scramble a cube, have it both be an embodiment of symmetry and complexity while still kind of retaining its properties as a cube? So just almost on a lark, he, working with some paper clips, rubber bands, and kind of rough wooden blocks, assembled what was this sort of archetype for the Rubik's Cube we know today. But he had no intention of it being a puzzle or something that kids would play with. It was just sort of, it started out as just kind of a fun teaching tool in his class.
And did he notice right away that when you move some of these cubes around that this thing was kind of hard to solve, to return to its original position?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, after playing with it a few times, he's like, wait a second, these colored squares are not easily returnable to their starting positions. And he kind of realized, I've got something more here. This isn't just a teaching tool, but it's a kind of puzzle.
So how did it go from that, this thing that was jerry-rigged with paper clips and rubber bands, to the Rubik's Cube that we know today?
Well, it's kind of a long story. You have to remember that this cube sort of made its debut in communist Hungary. And so, it wasn't a place that was, had a lot of ties to the West. And, he had to first work with these, Hungarian manufacturing cooperatives, and then get in touch with these, Hungarian state trading companies. And it was a very slow process. So for the first few years after he invented it, it sort of was just sold in Hungary. And it did pretty well there, but it didn't really go anywhere else. There were, mathematicians in the West managed to get a couple of these things smuggled out because they were just fascinated by this toy. But it didn't really become like a mainstream thing in the West until a Hungarian businessman sort of got the attention of this British sort of toy guru who brought it to New York, the New York Toy Fair, in the late 70s and then in 1980. But even then, it took a while. Many of the major toy companies passed on it. They said, this thing's too cerebral. I don't really get it. It probably isn't even solvable. Who's going to buy this thing?
Right.
And then eventually, yeah.
And there was one toy company did take up on it, obviously, and picked up the Rubik's Cube. But was it a hard sell? How did it catch on at that company?
Well, it was funny because I interviewed one of the executives at that company. It was called Ideal Toy Company. It's not around anymore, but it actually was a toy company that had gotten rich off another classic toy, the teddy bear, way back, in the early 1900s. So it had this history of sort of being able to pick winners. And there was actually just sort of a meeting among executives there where they were looking at this kind of toy lineup for the next season. And one of the executives, just not to show it off or anything, just because he was kind of bored at the meeting, he'd sort of heard about the lineup enough times, started just goofing around with this strange cube. And the chief executive of this company, of Ideal, said, "Hey, what are you doing? Stop that. That's kind of annoying," because it was making this, clicking sound. And so that led to a conversation like, what is this thing? How does it work? Where are people buying it? And so the chief executive said, well, maybe we'll do this, but the first thing you have to do is we need one of you to go over to Hungary to make sure this thing is solvable.
Do you think that clicking that you talked about, as some people find it annoying, but I think that's sort of the appeal of the Rubik's Cubes. It makes these satisfying clicks as you move it around, and it feels kind of good in your hands even while you're focused on something.
Absolutely, and that's what makes it so wonderful. It is a very, it appeals to sort of many of your senses. You can hear it clicking, you can feel it in your hands, and there's these bright sort of candy color stickers on its six sides, and so it really sort of does engage all of the senses.
It was a huge hit in the 80s, and then you said it died out, but it's coming back now, and now we've got the phenomenon of speed cubing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so speed cubing is this, you know, people had always, from the very start, especially, again, these PhD mathematicians who sort of fell in love with a cube, were looking for, like, the most efficient way to solve a cube. Like, what was the minimum number of turns by which any cube in any configuration could be solved? And I think they actually call that the God number, and I think the God number now is 20 or something. But you know, kids are doing this, too, and you know, teenagers are obviously the most prolific users of the Rubik's Cube, and, you know, one of the reasons for the resurgence is simply the Internet. These cubers who had been kind of cubing in the shadows, unaware of one another's existence, you know, found each other on YouTube and Facebook and sort of sharing tricks and tips for how to solve the cube quickly, and then they began organizing these tournaments, you know, which started out in 2003 with something like 90 participants, and as of 2013 had more than 10,000 participants. And these are now taking place in something like 50 cities across the globe. And, you know, a bunch of teenagers basically get together, and they try to solve the cube faster than anybody else. And one of the cool things is that it's not just, you know, the 3x3 conventional cube that we think of today, but there are also competitions for the 2x2 cube, the 4x4, the 5x5, and probably one of the strangest things, and I'm forgetting the actual term for this, but it's like blind cubing, where essentially you look at a scrambled Rubik's Cube for like 5 seconds, and then someone puts a blindfold on you. How long does it take you to solve the cube with a blindfold on? In other words, you have to have a perfect memory, visual memory of the cube's configuration before the blindfold comes on.
There are people in the world who can solve it like that?
Apparently. I don't know any of them, but... But apparently there are enough geniuses out there that can have a perfect visual picture of the cube.
That is crazy. Well, Scientific American printed a quote about the Rubik's Cube that it called it a model and a metaphor for all that is profound and beautiful in science. So obviously it's a lot of fun, but do you think that is also true? Is it profound and beautiful?
Well, I think there is a kind of beauty, and this was right after the Rubik's Cube came out. Scientific American in 1981, I believe, did a cover story on it, written by this Pulitzer Prize-winning cognitive scientist named Douglas Hofstadter, who just, you know, gushed about the cube, because he did see scientific principles embodied in the way you tried to solve it. And without getting too deep in the weeds, it has quite a bit of relevance to something called algebraic group theory in mathematics, which deals with, you know, groups of clusters of patterns and how they can be resolved. And so I think scientists and mathematicians saw in the abstraction of the cube, a kind of beauty and purity. And that's one of the things I think that still resonates with a lot of people. It's clearly, it's languageless. You don't need to speak any language to engage with it. And there's something both primitive about it, but also very modern seeming. There was a professor I spoke to who I didn't get a chance to quote in my piece in Smithsonian Magazine, but who is a toy expert at the University of Minnesota, Barry Kudrowitz, who said, you know, this, I asked him to explain the continuing allure of the Rubik's Cube, and he said it really, you know, it has both the complexity of chess, which is, you know, sort of a classic game, but kind of the sleek design aesthetic of like an iPod. And so on the one hand, it has all these sort of classic elements of complexity that are abstract. On the other hand, there is something quite beautiful about its design. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that back in the early 80s, sort of right as it was cresting as a fad, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York added a Rubik's Cube to its permanent collection.
That was Ariel Sabar, author, journalist, and correspondent for Smithsonian Magazine.